Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Karim Saad-Jadpour, who is an associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He joined Carnegie after 4 years as the chief Iran analyst at the International Crisis Group based in Tehran and Washington, D.C. He's a regular contributor to BBC World TV and Radio, CNN, National Public Radio, and PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. Karim, welcome to Berkeley.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in Michigan. My parents, obviously, are immigrants from Iran. My father left Iran in the late 1950s. My mother came in the 70s, and I think they always thought that one day they would go back to Iran and settle, but when the revolution happened in 1979, they stayed put in Michigan, and that's, for the most part, where I was born and raised.
What does your experience tell us about the Iranian diaspora in the United States?
Well, I think that my experience was similar to maybe the experience of many Iranians of my generation, that growing up in the aftermath of the hostage crisis and the 1979 revolution, I think initially people weren't proud of advertising the fact that they were Iranian. But as time passed and I think people became more settled here in the United States, became more comfortable, I think then they felt more comfortable speaking openly or being open about their Iranian identity. And again, I think when Khatami was elected in 1997, it put a new face on Iran for the world, and especially for Iranian Americans. And I think, you know, the tragedy right now is that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is really erasing a lot of the goodwill that President Khatami helped establish.
So in a way, you want, there's kind of ups and downs in your feeling for Iranian, your positive effect toward Iran and feeling within yourself Iranian nationalism, really.
Yeah, well, it's there are definitely ups and downs in the sense that, you know, there are times when, I think in 1997, we were very hopeful about the prospect for a more liberal, democratic Iran. I think right now, we don't see the same light at the end of the tunnel. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, as a Tehran taxi driver once told me, this is a culture with 2,500 years of civilization and history, and there are going to be these ups and downs, but Iran will remain. Iran has been around for 2,500 years, and you know, the current clerics in power and President Ahmadinejad, they will never be able to you know, they can temporarily tarnish the reputation of Iran, but Iran will remain.
So tell us about your education. Where did you do your undergraduate work and then your graduate work?
Yeah, I did my undergraduate work at the University of Michigan. And going to college, I wasn't really interested in academics. I was a soccer player, and I aspired to play professional soccer. And after my second year, my sophomore year in college, I had an injury and I had to hang up the boots and focus more on academics. So I studied political science and film. I did a double major. Mm-hmm. And as I said, you know, when President Khatami was elected, it was my junior year of college, and I suddenly became interested in the Middle East. And then when I graduated from college, I had received a grant, a scholarship to travel around the world from an organization called the Circumnavigators Club. And the one thing they asked me to do was to spend some time in the Middle East. And I'd actually never been to the Middle East before then. I had lived, as I said, in Mexico, in Spain, in Italy, but I'd never lived in the Middle East. So I said, well, it's the least I can do to oblige them. They've given me this money to travel around. So I went to Egypt. And this, for me, was really an eye-opening experience. I really loved Egypt. I loved the culture. Something felt very familiar to me. So this intersection between, you know, seeing the Middle East culturally and being interested in it intellectually and politically, I suddenly became very interested in learning more about the region, and I ended up going to Tehran for the first time the summer of 2001. I spent 3 months there, and I saw a lot of my family again, my 100-year-old grandmother living in Tehran. And from then I went to graduate school at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and I focused on the Middle East there as well.
Mm-hmm. Iran is an important country across the board on a number of issues: oil security, terrorism, regional stability, Iraq, proliferation, and Arab-Israeli peace. It is an important player. I get that list from one of the articles that that you wrote. So I think it would be helpful for our audience if we could discuss what's going on in Iran. We just had the visit of Iran's president. And, I mean, the first question that comes to mind is, how powerful is he? Who really runs that country?
Yeah, it's a very important question because, despite his title as president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad isn't the most powerful individual in Iran. And the Iranian constitution really, most of the power in the Iranian constitution is in the hands of unelected officials, and mainly the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who's been in power now since Ayatollah Khomeini, really the father of the revolution, passed away in 1989. So Ayatollah Khamenei has been in power about 17 years. And then you have other unelected branches, the Guardian Council, the Assembly of Experts, the Expediency Council. It's really this Byzantine government with these very interesting sounding names. Where President Ahmadinejad fits into this is that he is a player at the table. You know, decisions in Iran are made by consensus. It's not a dictatorship like Saddam Hussein's Iraq was, or Assad's Syria's, Hafez al-Assad's Syria's, where you have one individual making decisions. It's a consensus-building process. So I think if there's 15 or so main individuals in Iran who are helping make decisions, I think President Ahmadinejad definitely has a seat at the table. The institution of the presidency is an important one. And what we've seen from President Ahmadinejad's presidency, if we want to look at the glass half full, is that an assertive president in Iran really can make a difference, because throughout 8 years of President Khatami's tenure, we had kind of reached the conclusion that the presidency in Iran is a very weak institution. But I think it was actually because President Khatami himself was a very weak individual who didn't really assert himself. That's why we saw that. But I think when you have a very assertive president like Ahmadinejad, we see that he actually can make a fairly large difference on Iran's foreign policy and also Iran's domestic policy. But he's not calling the shots when it comes to the nuclear issue or relations with the U.S. or Iran's role in Iraq, these major issues.
So he seems to be playing the international audience in order to bolster his importance at home, or at least that seems to be the consequence. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it, in the sense that an interesting point to look at is, you know, why on earth these pronouncements against Israel? Israel should be wiped off the map. He's denied the Holocaust. Because this doesn't really make much sense in the domestic Iranian context. If you look at Iran, it doesn't have any land or border disputes with Israel. There's no Palestinian refugee problem in Iran. And Iran actually has a long history of tolerance vis-a-vis Jewish people. Iran, you know, it surprises many to know that Iran has the largest Jewish community in the Middle East outside of Israel. There's still about 25,000 Jews living in Iran. So this, in addition to the fact that Iranians have this certain Persian chauvinism towards the Arabs, and the Palestinian issue doesn't really resonate among Iranians as it does among Arabs, it doesn't really make much sense in the domestic Iranian context why Ahmadinejad is railing against Israel, denying the Holocaust. But from the inception of the revolution in 1979, it's always been very important for Iran's leadership to be considered the vanguard of the Arab and Muslim world, to be the vanguard of the Islamic Middle East. So in that context, it does make sense that when you hear these pronouncements against Israel, denial of the Holocaust, it really appeals to the broader Arab and Muslim world much more so than Iranians. And I think that from the standpoint of Iran's leadership, they've always put even greater emphasis on what the Arab and Muslim world at large feels about them than their own street.
So in a way, so I guess the interesting question is, how provincial is the president? Or is it that not so much that he's provincial, but savvy playing this card for its benefit?
Yeah, he's provincial in the sense that he's not someone who's very globally oriented or very sophisticated in terms of his worldview. I've seen him up close before. He gave a speech once to a group of us, and the title of his speech was Why Iran is the Best Country in the World. Mm-hmm. And this was at a time when he had probably visited maybe two or three countries in his life. It was shortly after he became inaugurated president. So I don't think he's very savvy when it comes to global matters. And he is convinced right now, as are many Iranian leaders, that there's such a great degree of anti-Americanism and enmity towards the Bush administration that this then means sympathy towards Iran's position. And, you know, what's very interesting when you read the Iranian press these days is that especially when you read the hardline newspapers, which are very dismissive in their approach towards democratic elections in Iran, when it comes to the Middle East at large, they believe that the best vehicle for Iran to assert its interests throughout the Middle East is actually, ironically, democratic elections, because they say when democratic elections happen in the Middle East, our friends get elected. Hamas in Palestine, Hezbollah in Lebanon, our Shiite co-religionists in Iraq, Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. So this is one of the great ironies of President Bush's approach towards this push towards for democracy in the Middle East, is that you have a leadership like Iran's that says, indeed, let's have democratic elections throughout the Middle East, because when we have democratic elections, politicians come to office who are more sympathetic to Tehran than they are to Washington.
Now, the real power in Iran is the supreme leader, the Ayatollah. Tell us a little about him and his perspective on the world.
Yeah, it's a very... I'm actually doing a longer expose right now of Ayatollah Khamenei, and he's an interesting character. He's been in power now for 18 years, since Khomeini's death in 1989. And he's someone who I describe as being paralyzed with mistrust. He's so mistrustful of U.S. intentions that he hasn't been able to really make any bold decisions in his tenure as supreme leader. I think on one hand, given the fact that he was president during the time of the Iran-Iraq war, when the country was very much in political and economic isolation, he doesn't want to relive those days of confrontation. So he's not eager to embark on a military confrontation with the United States, perhaps like President Ahmadinejad might be. On the other hand, as I said, he's so mistrustful of U.S. intentions that he believes that any type of compromise Iran makes is not going to be rewarded by goodwill from the United States, but it's going to be perceived as a sign of weakness from the United States and invite even more pressure. So he's someone who I describe as being averse to both confrontation and accommodation.
So he follows the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was I guess the founding Ayatollah, you would say, and Khomeini set in place a structure that is very, very complicated. And you write in one of your pieces that he was determined that parts of Iran, that is of the government, should be able to check each other so there would not be external influence by the United States and other Western powers, of course, because of this long history of both Britain and the United States focused on the matter of oil to such an extent that they were willing to depose a regime.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, for many people, the 1979 revolution was a quest for independence. And, you know, this current leadership, especially and Ayatollah Khomeini especially, looked at the Shah's regime, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi's government, as essentially a puppet regime of the United States. It was a patron-client relationship with the United States. So they put so much emphasis on Iran's independence that they wanted to create this type of government which would have these checks and balances that it would be essentially impenetrable to outside forces. So there wouldn't be one individual who could be potentially corrupted by the United States or by the West, but it would be several parallel bodies of power which, you know, taken together would be impossible for all of them to be co-opted by the United States. And essentially this has created a government which has a very difficult time making decisions. It's very difficult to get a decision made in Iran, because I said it's this consensus building process. There's not one dictator who is issuing edicts, so it's very difficult to make pronouncements or make decisions in Iran which necessarily break with past tradition of the 1979 revolution. So I can tell you, having been based in Iran, that I would argue the vast majority of officials within the Iranian government realized that in 2007 it's not really helpful to continue these calls for death to America and death to Israel, that this is kind of a bankrupt mantra. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult to do away with these past policies simply because you do have these individuals who are in a minority, but they're still powerful, and you can't reach any consensus without them being at the table as well.
Iran must be complicated in the sense of building on a civilization that's 2,500 years old. There must be a professional foreign service establishment that comes out of that tradition on the one hand, but on the other hand, with the establishment of an Islamic republic, mm-hmm. that acting on the basis of Sharia and Islamic law, that must set up a real complication as it deals with the world.
Yeah. Well, for anyone to be an Iranian official, especially as part of, say, the Iranian Foreign Ministry, there are certain vetting processes and filtering processes which take place. For example, it's impossible for anyone who says, who wears a tie and says religion and state should be separated to become an Iranian official, to enter the Iranian system. They would be filtered out. In terms of, for example, the presidency in Iran, it's women are not allowed to run. And essentially, candidates who don't declare allegiance to Iran's Khomeini system of government, Belayat-e-Faghi, are not permitted to run. When it comes to the foreign ministry, I think it's probably among the different branches of the Iranian government or different ministries. Like any foreign ministry around the world, you have people who are more internationally minded and I think somewhat more progressive in their thinking. So I think within the Iranian foreign ministry, I would even argue the vast majority of foreign ministry officials realize that Iran's approach towards the United States is unconstructive. Iran's pronouncements against Israel are probably unconstructive. But the foreign ministry is essentially a weak entity in today's Iran. There are much more functionaries and bureaucrats or apparatchiks, to use a Soviet comparison, than they are really devisers of policy.
Let's focus on a particular institution which is getting a lot of media attention because of signals that the Bush administration on our side is giving out, namely the Revolutionary Guard. Who are they? How many of them are they? And what is their role?
Yeah, the Revolutionary Guards are really emerging as what I call the X factor, the most important factor in Iranian politics, because they are very important not only on the political scene, but also on the economic scene. They're winning billion-dollar oil contracts, and they're essentially running Iranian foreign policy in places like Iraq and Lebanon and Afghanistan. So they're a very powerful force. They were created upon the inception of the revolution in 1979, and essentially what happened was Ayatollah Khomeini was mistrustful of the Shah's army. He said, you know, these guys were all trained by the Shah. The Shah's, the army was all trained by the Shah. And he questioned their allegiance to this newfound Islamic Republic. So the idea behind the creation of the Revolutionary Guards was the need for an independent military body which could be the protectors of the revolution. So it was created with this in mind. And it's really grown tremendously over time. Whereas in 1979, it was probably, you know, a ragtag group of hundreds. It's now emerged into Iran's most formidable fighting force. There are about 125,000 in number, and they have many different branches. They have their own navy. They have their own intelligence. And as I mentioned, as their political power has been increasing, their economic prowess has also been increasing. So it's very difficult to describe them as a monolith. As I mentioned, there are 125,000 in number. And what you see is that their senior commanders, because they are appointed by the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, they're publicly deferential to him and they're more hardline in their orientation. But the rank and file in some ways is much more representative of Iranian society at large. There are people who do want to see reforms take place. They do want to see economic reforms take place. And because the fact that they are military men and some of them have experienced the horrors of war, having fought in the Iran-Iraq war, they have a much less romantic view about confrontation and militarization than some of their civilian counterparts, which I think is somewhat similar to the experience we saw in the United States when you had individuals like Colin Powell, who had actually fought in war, being much more averse to the prospect of war than some of their civilian counterparts who had never fought in wars.
Mm-hmm. So, suggest in one of your articles that a high percentage of the Revolutionary Guard supported the reformist President Khatami.
Yeah, in 2000, what we saw in 1997 and 2001 was that when the barracks of the Revolutionary Guards, they had their own voting polls, and when they counted the ballots at these Revolutionary Guard barracks in 2001 and also in 1997, they found that almost three-quarters of these Revolutionary Guards had voted for Mohammad Khatami. Now, polling in Iran is a very inexact science and is very difficult to ascertain these things precisely. But I can tell you anecdotally as well, when you talk to not the senior command in the Revolutionary Guards, but when you talk to rank-and-file individuals, you know, they're fairly representative in a way of Iranian society at large. Some of them had not chosen to enter the Revolutionary Guards. They had simply been military conscripts who were entered into the Revolutionary Guards. And by and large, they have a lot of the same concerns and critiques of Iranian politics that, you know, everyday Iranians have.
Mm-hmm. So let's get a larger picture of Iran now, and we'll come back to the Revolutionary Guards in a minute. But for right now, talk a little about society. That is the percentage of the population that are young people who are modern, who want reform, and who would be a basis of support for a reformist leader.
Yeah. Iran is a very young population. So Iran's population was about 35 million in 1979. Then when the revolution happened, Ayatollah Khomeini encouraged people to go out and have a lot of children to produce this robust Islamic society. And now, 28 years later, the population has doubled. It's about 70 million now. And the majority of them are under 30. About two-thirds of the population is under 30.
Two-thirds
under 30, yeah. Under 32 or so.
Yeah.
So it's a very young population, and these, what we call these children of the revolution, they have no special loyalty towards the revolution. They have no enmity towards the ancien regime, the Shah's regime, because they didn't live under the Shah's regime. And they have the same demands that young people everywhere have, you know, jobs, economic opportunities, social opportunities, political freedoms. So overwhelmingly, the young Iranian population is discontent. And we did see this manifest itself in the 1997 election of President Khatami and his re-election in 2001. But at the same time, they're very averse to bloodshed and to chaos. So I think that it's a population which I think is looking for a reform-minded leader, but they're not looking for a revolution of any kind. And I think what's difficult to reconcile for those of us who watch Iran closely is kind of the distinction between Tehran and the rest of the country. Because Tehran is a city which has a high degree of internet penetration, a high degree of satellite television penetration. So Tehran residents are really urban sophisticates who are not reliant on official state media for their information, for their news. So what we see in Iranian elections is that a lot of Tehran residents, especially the younger generation, don't participate because they say, well, none of these candidates are candidates we particularly like. They're chosen for us by the government and we don't really want to participate. But what you see outside of Tehran is much less degree of satellite television penetration, internet penetration, and you have people more reliant on official state television for their only source of information. And this is where you see individuals like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad thrive, and this is why you see President Ahmadinejad now traveling a lot to the provinces and traveling outside of Tehran, because he says, this is my audience, not the urban sophisticates in Tehran.
And what about the economy? I mean, its apparent radical foreign policy is increasingly leading it to be isolated as an active participant in the international economy.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's quite remarkable that these days, with oil prices soaring and you have such a tremendous oil windfall elsewhere in the Persian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, I think, has accumulated $130 billion surplus. Kuwait, Qatar, these countries are accumulating billion-dollar surpluses. Iran is actually tapping into their oil surplus, despite the fact of these major oil windfalls. So the Iranian economy is really... it's highly mismanaged. There's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of subsidies. So in 2007, you still have gasoline in Tehran cheaper than water. It's cheaper to buy a liter of gasoline than it is a liter of water. 80% of the economy is still state-owned. And you have these bodies like the Revolutionary Guards who are doing a lot of controlling of trade, imports and exports. So if you're a private Iranian individual and you want to start a business, it's very difficult to get by. You're subject to a lot of tariffs and having to pay bribes and things like that. So the Iranian economy is really, as I said, mismanaged. And despite these major oil windfalls, it's not doing well. And I think that ultimately this is the Achilles heel of the Iranian government.
And it seems to be that Ahmadinejad is not delivering on the economic promises he made to the rural poor.
That's absolutely right. His President Ahmadinejad's mandate when he was elected was very clear. I was based in Tehran during the time of these elections, and I will say I never met anyone who said to me, I want to vote for Ahmadinejad because he wants to wipe Israel off the map or because he denies the Holocaust. His mandate was extremely clear. That was to, quote-unquote, put the oil money on people's dinner tables. And I think people viewed him as a common man, a simple man who maybe he wasn't going to deliver on these lofty economic promises, but at least people believed he wasn't going to enrich himself in the process of trying. He was perceived as incorruptible. And I think by and large as an individual, he's not someone who's considered corrupt. But I think he has indulged these forces around him, like the Revolutionary Guards and like certain clerics around him, in a way that they're really reaping the benefits. And you know, despite this oil windfall, I think the average Iranian's economic lot is much worse off than it was 2 years ago before his election. The major factors, the major economic indicators, inflation is up and unemployment is up.
So how, given this complexity of the internal structure, should we look at Iran's reaching out to the world? And here we have to focus on two aspects. One is the search for nuclear power, which probably is a quest for nuclear weapons on the one hand, and then Iran's policy toward Iraq. Let's talk about the nuclear issue first. Wouldn't any state in Iran's position, having seen our record in Iraq, seen the case of North Korea, and surrounded it as is by countries such as Pakistan on the one side and Iraq on the other, isn't it logical from an international relations perspective for them to be looking to acquire nuclear weapons?
No, not necessarily. I think if you had a different government in Tehran who didn't view themselves in this eternal enmity with the United States, who didn't make these pronouncements necessarily against Israel and did make much more of an effort to be at peace with the international community, to have better relations with the Europeans, with Iran's Arab neighbors, and again with the United States, I don't necessarily think they would have the same sense of insecurity. Mm-hmm. And I think I would argue that Iran's primary impetus for pursuing this nuclear weapons capability, and I would say they are pursuing nuclear weapons capability, not necessarily a weapons, but definitely the capability, I would argue it's out of a sense of insecurity vis-a-vis the United States. You know, they rationalize, Iran's leaders say, our revolution happened in 1979, The United States still hasn't come to terms with it. So if we get this nuclear weapons option, it will force them to respect this. But again, I think if you change that dynamic and you had an Iranian government which actually had a friendly relationship with the United States, I don't necessarily think it would feel compelled to pursue a nuclear weapon. I think Turkey is a good example of that. It's a government which is in NATO. It has a friendly relationship with the United States, and it feels that it's under the NATO security umbrella and under the security umbrella of the United States, so it doesn't feel compelled to pursue a nuclear weapons program. So I do think that it's not necessarily a given that any Iranian government would be doing the same thing that the current government is doing on the nuclear issue.
And on the nuclear issue, are there divisions among the major players about what choices should be made?
Absolutely. I think this is a debate which, quite frankly, we're not privy to. I think these are made and these conversations are had in small rooms, and there's probably not more than a dozen people in these rooms. But broadly speaking, my experience always in talking to Iranian officials was that there is a diversity of opinion. You have some officials, like, for example, the former ambassador to the United Nations, Javad Zarif, who used to say that pursuing a nuclear weapon would actually augment Iran's vulnerabilities more than its security, that it would draw more unwanted attention to Iran, and it would undermine Iran's conventional military superiority in the Middle East, because what would happen is that if the day after Iran went nuclear, then all of a sudden Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt would also pursue the same option, and Iran's conventional superiority would be canceled out. So you do have a lot of officials who are concerned that this would bring more unwanted attention to Iran. But then you do have others who believe that similar to Israeli leaders, they have this notion that there's an existential threat against them, that the United States would ultimately wants to see a different type of regime in Tehran, and that the only way they can have a cloak of immunity or a security umbrella around them is to pursue this nuclear weapons capability. So I think these debates are continuing to take place in Tehran. And I would argue that when you do have this hardline rhetoric coming out of Washington, it probably strengthens the arguments of those within the Iranian system who say, we cannot trust the Americans. They're still talking about all options being on the table, and we need to not be naive about this and pursue this nuclear weapons deterrent.
And if they were to pursue that deterrent, where are they in the race to acquire nuclear weapons? Do you have a sense of that?
Well, this is also very imprecise. If you talk to the Israelis, Iran crossed the nuclear threshold a year ago. I think by CIA standards, the estimate was between 5 to 7 years. So every few months we hear news coming out about where Iran is technologically when it comes to the nuclear issue. And sometimes this news surprises in terms of how advanced they are, and sometimes it surprises in terms of how far behind they are and how much time there is for diplomacy. So I think by and large there's at least a few more years before Iran has mastered the technology. They have shown themselves to be fairly adept. But at the same time, they're dealing with equipment which they've acquired through the black market, which they don't necessarily have the knowledge to replicate if the equipment breaks. So it's very difficult to ascertain where they are precisely, but I think what we can say with confidence is that there is a lot of time, and by a lot of time I mean at least a few years, before Iran is close to crossing that nuclear weapons capability threshold.
The second point of contention that in the next year or so, while the Bush administration is still in power, is going to be a focal point for possible confrontation, if not war, is the role of the Revolutionary Guards in Iraq. The Bush administration is increasingly focusing on the provision of arms and particular weapons to the insurgents in Iraq. And also there seems to be confusion about who is being aided, whether it's Shia militias or whether it's actually al-Qaeda in Iraq, which would be somewhat of a puzzle given the Sunni-Shia split. So give us a handle on which to think about that. Is the Revolutionary Guard doing what the U.S. says, and is it an autonomous player?
Well, it's a great question, Harry, and I think we should go back to 2003 when the Iraq War was prosecuted. If you remember, one of the premises of the Iraq War was to rid Saddam Hussein of WMD, but another one of the premises, maybe even a stronger premise, was to, quote-unquote, change the political culture of the Middle East, and this notion that if we establish a secular liberal democracy in Iraq, then it's going to spread throughout the region and primarily in Tehran. So I think from the very outset of the Iraq War, Iran's leadership didn't feel it had a very positive incentive to play a constructive role in Iraq. If simply a successful American enterprise in Iraq was going to mean that the neocons were going to transfer the regime change policy eastward to Tehran. So I think from the very beginning, Iran's leaders actually felt an incentive to make life more difficult for the United States and Iraq. And at the same time, Iran experienced on their northern flank in Afghanistan a 20-year civil war. There was a two-decade civil war in Afghanistan, which produced an influx of Afghan refugees in Iran. So they didn't want to see Iraq totally succumb to civil war or split up into three entities. The prospect of an independent Iraqi Kurdistan has strong implications for Iran's own Kurdish community. So there was this balancing act taking place for a number of years, where on one hand, Iranians wanted to see the Americans learn a very expensive lesson in Iraq. On the other hand, they didn't want to see Iraq totally break down. So we called this, when I was working for the International Crisis Group, we called Iran's policy in Iraq one of managed chaos. They wanted to see chaos in Iraq, but of a manageable kind. And the way they've gone about doing this is quite interesting. And it's kind of the equivalent of an investor who has a very diverse portfolio of funds. Or if you want to take a gambling analogy, it's like putting money on every number on the roulette table. So Iran is essentially investing in all different types of actors in Iraq. Obviously, they're Shiite co-religionists, individuals like Ayatollah Sistani, but also more radical Shiite individuals like Muqtada Saad. And then Iran has decent ties with mainstream Kurdish groups, Talibani's group, and also the mainstream Kurdish leadership, but also more Islamist Kurdish leadership like the Ansar al-Islam. And even the Sunni leadership as well, Sunni insurgents who have blown up Iran's Shiite friends, Iran claims to have a rapport with. So it's very interesting that they've really put their money everywhere in Iraq. And they do believe that as long as the United States is in Iraq, that I think the from Iran's perspective, the status quo for them right now is okay, because they have their main adversary, the United States, bleeding very heavily, blood and treasure. But at the same time, they have their friends, their Shiite co-religionists, in a position of power and influence. But they realize that this status quo is not going to be able to carry on forever. So I think that's why right now they sense their hand is very strong in Iraq. Oil prices are soaring. Their hand is strong throughout the region. And they're very interested in continuing this dialogue with the United States in Baghdad to see what they can get in return from the U.S.
But both of these issues strike me as being very volatile ones, so that the decision makers in Washington, the people running for president, have the opportunity to overstate the implications of what Iran is up to, either on the question of Iraq or on the nuclear issue. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's very difficult because both of these issues are very nebulous. Iran's nuclear program is fairly nebulous. It's very difficult to ascertain where they are precisely. So the U.S. can issue these statements where Iran is, and it's very difficult for Iran to counter them because on one hand, there's no smoking gun, quote unquote, to show that Iran is indeed pursuing a nuclear weapons program. It's very difficult for Iran to really allay people's concerns entirely that they're not pursuing a nuclear weapons program. And when it comes to Iran's role in Iraq, it's also very difficult to ascertain precisely what's going on in Iraq. So I think when you have a government like you have right now in Tehran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, someone who's issued such belligerent statements towards Israel, which in the context of domestic U.S. policy is a very important issue. I think it's much more difficult to give Iran the benefit of the doubt that it is playing a constructive role in Iraq and its nuclear intentions are purely peaceful. And it makes it much easier for U.S. presidential candidates and U.S. legislators to issue these pronouncements against Iran, because there's not much of a lobby within the United States calling for a dialogue with Iran.
Mm-hmm. In the first Bush administration, when now Vice President Cheney was Secretary of Defense, his team wrote a proposal, a memorandum on how the U.S. should define its relationship to the world after the fall of the Soviet Union. And the argument was that we were the only superpower, and it was in our interest to prevent the rise of a regional power in any major region of the world that might then question our leadership of that part of the world and ultimately our hegemonic leadership of the world. If we're acting in the world by that formula, and let's just assume that, is Iran a threat as a result of the unintended consequence of the Iraq war?
I think using that paradigm, absolutely. Absolutely. It then becomes a zero-sum game between the United States and Iran for power and influence in the Middle East. And if you listen to the rhetoric of Iranian officials, it's quite interesting. Whereas in 2002 or 2003, they may have asked for security assurances from the United States, some type of security guarantees that the U.S. wouldn't attack Iran. I think now, fast forward to 2007, it's a totally different world. In 2003, you had student agitations taking place in Tehran. Oil prices were $20 a barrel. Iran didn't wield the same type of regional influence. But now, Iran really feels it's riding high, and it can afford to act for ask for much more from the United States. So, from the perspective of Iranian officials, Iran right now is the regional hegemon. And I think what that means and what they want the United States to understand is that all of the major issues in the Middle East, outstanding issues in the Middle East, if the U.S. wants to resolve them, Tehran has to have a seat at the table. Mm. Meaning, if you want peace in Iraq, you have to engage Iran. If you want even Arab-Israeli peace, you have to engage Iran. If you want peace in the Levant, in Lebanon, Iran has tremendous influence, you have to engage Iran. If you want Persian Gulf security, you have to engage Iran. So Iran wants to make this clear to the United States that the U.S. can't assert themselves and their hegemony in the Middle East with Iran having a say in it. And I think if you listen again to the rhetoric of Iranian officials, they're trying to sell themselves and market themselves to the Arab countries as kind of the new custodians of security for the Middle East, and telling the Arab countries, especially the Persian Gulf countries, sever this relationship you have with the United States. This relationship hasn't brought security to the Middle East. And let's be the custodians of our own security, with the implicit message that Iran would be the main custodian and the main policeman of security in the Persian Gulf.
What would be the danger if, in the last 18 months of the Bush administration, if we were to go to war with Iran over either the nuclear issue or the Iraq issue?
Well, to be blunt, I think on both issues, the idea, I think bombing Iran would only produce more chaos in Iraq. So if we want to stabilize Iraq, I think if we bomb Iran, the likelihood that Iraq will go up into flames even more is very strong. I think on the nuclear issue, again, if we try to get inside the heads of Iranian officials, and the primary impetus for many of their nuclear ambitions is the sense of insecurity vis-a-vis the United States, I think if we bomb Iran, we only validate this belief among many of them that the U.S. is intent on changing the regime in Tehran, and therefore we need to pursue nuclear deterrence. So I think on both of these issues, we would exacerbate Iraq and exacerbate the chaos in Iraq by bombing Iran. And by bombing Iran with regards to the nuclear issue, I think we will only harden the belief and we will increase the numbers of those officials who believe that There's no other choice but pursuing this nuclear deterrent.
So what do you argue should be American strategy? I mean, after listening to you and your survey of the country, it's really a complex situation. So any lever that you push seems to have the potential of having unintended consequences. Yeah. Consequences. So help us understand what you see as an appropriate strategy for the United States.
Yeah, it is indeed very complex, and I don't envy those European or American officials who devise an approach toward or having to devise a policy toward Iran, because it is obviously very complex. I think if we were having this conversation during the era of Mohammad Khatami, the reform-minded president, when he was calling for a dialogue of civilizations, I think a much stronger argument could have been made for engagement. I think right now having dialogue with Iran is still the right policy, because again, we're not going to be able to ameliorate Iraq without talking to Iran. I don't think we're going to dissuade them from pursuing this nuclear option without talking to them. I do think, though, that offering major incentives to Iran is problematic these days when you have a president like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in power, because If we look at the debate which has been taking place in Tehran, the hardliners in Tehran were always very critical of Mohammad Khatami. They said this dialogue of civilizations talk was very cute, but all it got was all it got for us was entry into the axis of evil, and it projected a weak image of the country. And what we need to do instead is take a very hardline, non-compromising approach, and this is what the West responds to. So I do think it is problematic for the United States and for the Europeans to offer major incentives to an Iran under Ahmadinejad that we didn't offer an Iran under Khatami, because we will essentially validate the worldview of these hardliners in Tehran who believe that when you take a hardline approach, it reaps rewards. And again, we don't only validate their approach toward Iraq and the nuclear issue, but also their broader worldview. And this is a government which right now is publicly executing homosexuals, which has re-implemented the punishment of stoning women to death and stoning individuals to death for adultery. So I do think it is problematic. So what I would argue from a perspective of a Western official is to continue the dialogue with Iran about Iraq, because there are a lot of common points. There are a lot of overlapping interests between the United States and Iran in Iraq. And hopefully you gradually expand that dialogue to encompass the nuclear issue as well. But I do think for the moment it is also very imperative for the United States and for the international community to send the message to Tehran that a belligerent foreign policy is not going to reap you any rewards. And I think what's absolutely key is some type of coherence, international coherence in dealing with Iran, meaning you have the United States, the Europeans, Russia, and China on the same page and sending the same signal to Tehran. And eventually what you will see in Iran is a change of leadership, because again, President Ahmadinejad's mandate when he was elected was very clear. It was to improve the economy. He's failed remarkably in doing that. And what you will see is probably he and his colleagues will not be reelected when it comes to the parliamentary elections of 2008, the presidential elections of 2009. And I do think you will see the return of more moderate officials in Iran who are more amenable to a diplomatic compromise. And then you create the groundwork for some type of a diplomatic accommodation between the United States and Iran somewhere down the line, say in 2009. But as long as you have President Bush in Washington and President Ahmadinejad in Tehran, I think the depth of mutual mistrust and ill will is simply too deep to be overcome.
Now, if the leadership would change in both places, it seems there are still substantial obstacles if future leaders embrace some of the ideological aspects of the position of the two leaders. So, for example, on our side, in the U.S., this notion of democratizing the Middle East, yeah, of transforming regimes to create the stability in the region that we think is appropriate, that's just not going to fly, even if it were President Hillary Clinton or President Barack Obama who embraced those ideas.
That's absolutely right. And again, we should try to get inside the head of the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. What he believes is that all of these issues, whether it's Iran's support for Hezbollah, Iran's nuclear ambitions, he views these as a pretext. He thinks what the United States really wants deep down is a return to the relationship with Iran, which they had during the time of the Shah, which was essentially a patron-client relationship. So you somehow need to disabuse the supreme leader of this notion that the United States wants to see a different government in Tehran. And that means whether implicitly or explicitly, sending the message to Tehran that, okay, we don't like your behavior, we don't like your external behavior, but you know, our goal is really behavior change, not regime change, and we're willing to live with you. And I know that Condi Rice has made this public, but at the same time, when you have two U.S. aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf, it's easy to see why Iran gets a conflicting signal. So I think we do have to somehow send a signal to Tehran that, okay, we want to see a behavior change, but we're not interested in a regime change. That's right.
Well, one of the arguments you hear a lot of is the implications of the Shia-Sunni split for what might be achieved in the region. So, for example, we hear talk on the western side of an alliance of the Sunni states against Iran. How important is that that division, which has only recently become apparent to policymakers in the West? How important is that, and what does it bode for the stability of the region?
It's a very important question, and I think this issue has really been misinterpreted in the West, meaning there is this notion somehow that Iran is trying to foment sectarian unrest, whether it's in Iraq or throughout the region. But on the contrary, sectarian unrest, this Sunni-Shiite schism, is really inimical to Iran's interests, because what Iran ultimately wants, as I mentioned earlier, is to be the vanguard of the entire Middle East, the entire Islamic world. So they were cognizant of the fact that Shiites only represent about 10% of the region's Muslims, and if they try to project Shiite power, it's not really going to resonate. So they're trying to project this pan-Islamic power, and when you do have these Sunni-Shiite tensions start to exacerbate and this rift between the two sides grow, it's much more difficult for Iran to project this wide power, because there's this Sunni resentment towards the fact that Iran is Shiite. So Iran has done their best to try to mend these Sunni-Shiite tensions, and I think that's one reason also why you have Iran playing the Palestinian card so strongly, is trying to, you know, unite the Arab street behind their position, make the Arab street more sympathetic to the nuclear position. But I think from the standpoint of the United States and certain Arab leaders, this is an attractive way at countering Iranian soft power, playing this Sunni-Shiite mm-hmm. card. And I think it's no coincidence that you have leaders like King Abdullah of Jordan or Hosni Mubarak of Egypt recognize the fact that they're never going to be able to outdo Iran when it comes to the Palestinian issue, but they can counter the sympathy on the Egyptian street to the Jordanian street about Iran. By raising this issue of Shiites. Hosni Mubarak said that Arab Shiites are more sympathetic to Iran than to their own government. King Abdullah of Jordan talked about a Shiite crescent. And I think from the standpoint of these leaders, increasing this rift between Sunni and Shiite is one of the few tools they have in their toolbox at countering Iranian soft power in the region right now.
And this is a point that we should emphasize, although there's really no comparison between American and Western military might and Iran's, but on the other hand, Iran has at its disposal what you're calling soft power.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we look at this arms deal, which recently took place a couple of months back. The United States has offered Saudi Arabia $20 billion in additional military hardware. And I think this is really the wrong approach towards containing Iran. Because if you look at the numbers right now, Iran already spends about one-fourth of what Saudi Arabia spends in terms of its military expenditure. Yet, by all accounts, if you were to ask any Middle East expert nowadays and say, well, which country in the region is really rising, which country is in the ascent, which country's influence is rising throughout the region, I think everyone would tell you it's Iran's. And I think that's due to their soft power and their support for militias like Hezbollah in Lebanon, Shiite militias in Iraq, which, you know, are able to counter all this sophisticated military hardware. Now, it's interesting that when Arabs are asked which country, which leader in the Middle East do they most admire, usually the top three answers are Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the President of Iran, and Khalid Mishal, the leader of Hamas. But when you ask a follow-up question about, among Arabs, and you say, okay, which country in the region would you most like to live? Iran is not even in the top 10. The majority of them respond Dubai. Mm-hmm. So I think when we look at Arab popular romanticism about Iran, I think it's akin to what we saw in Latin America in the 60s and 70s, this romanticism that Latin Americans had about Castro's Cuba. It was this defiant political order which they admired from afar, but which they wouldn't necessarily wish upon themselves. And I think likewise in the Middle East, people romanticize Iran for the way it stands up to the United States, for the way it stands up to Israel. But I think few of them would probably want to live under an Iranian system. And I think this is what we need to emphasize from a policy perspective, is creating societies in places like Dubai, where I say young Arabs are talking about Islamic bonds, not Islamic bombs, and improving their economies. So when young Arabs look at Iran, they say, you know, this is a bankrupt economic model. We should actually be learning what not to do from them, not what to do from them.
One final question and a brief answer. As students watch this interview, it seems to me that looking at your career, that there's a real role for individuals who come out of diaspora communities to kind of help educate about relations between states. Is that a fair assessment?
Sure. I think especially when we have countries like Iran or countries like in the Arab world, which are so important right now in terms of policy, and languages which are much more difficult to learn and which are in high demand right now, I think the ability to play some type of a bridge or a constructive role at helping to allay some of the tensions, there's a real opportunity there for I think students who are steeped in the culture of the East but have been raised in the cultures of the West.
On that note, Karim, thank you very much for being here today and really giving us this wonderful overview of Iran and U.S. Iranian
relations.
Thank you,
Harry. Great pleasure.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.